from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
You know, every year we march for life. Does our protest really matter? This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DiMello and pro-life leader Abby Johnson take up that question as they look at where the pro-life movement is making inroads in the fight for life and for women. Then Jeanette talks with March for Life speaker Sue Ellen Browder, the author of Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DiMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Abby Johnson, was a clinic director for Planned Parenthood, our nation's largest abortion provider. In 2009, Abby was asked to assist with an ultrasound-guided abortion. That was a moment of conversion for her. She is now the author of the best-selling book Unplanned, which chronicles both her experiences within Planned Parenthood and her dramatic exit. She is also the founder of And Then There Were None, a ministry that assists abortion clinic workers in leaving that industry. So far, more than 150 workers have been helped. Today, Abby shares with us her insights on the March for Life and where the pro-life movement is heading.
Abby, it's great to have you on Register Radio. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You know, every year people go out to the march. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people. We're never sure exactly how many. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, is the March for Life still relevant? And how do you answer that question?
You know, people ask me, they say, you know, gosh, Abby, aren't you tired of sort of coming and preaching to the choir, in a sense? And I guess my answer to that is always, well, yeah, I mean, I guess in a sense we are sort of preaching to the choir, but we're living in a day and time where now it's time to teach our choir to sing. Mm. You know, it's time to really teach the pro-life masses to be better pro-life apologists for our movement. And that's one of the things that the march really helps equip us to do. And so I think it's important for us to come together to do that.
Yeah, and the theme of this year is pro-life and pro-women go hand in hand. And I imagine this theme must be really dear to your own heart because it reflects your own journey.
Yeah, it does. And I think for, you know, many, many years, we've sort of seen groups of people directing the narrative on both sides of the movement that maybe don't really accurately represent women's voices. You know, I think for many, many years, it was, even in the pro-life movement, you know, we've seen sort of this male voice dominating the pro-life movement. And if women spoke, it was sort of like, well, women are going to speak from a place of being victimized by the pro-life movement. And, you know, today in the pro-life movement, we are seeing women in a place of authority. I mean, we are seeing women lead the pro-life movement. And I think that that's important. And, you know, and then from the you know, pro-choice position, we're seeing sort of the narrative being directed by women saying, you know, oh, well, you know, women should be pro-choice and women are pro-choice. And, you know, by and large, I think the majority of women in the United States do defend life in the womb and do not believe in abortion on demand. And so I think it's important. I think the theme of this march is important. And I think sort of reclaiming that narrative in both movements and saying, you know, women are leading this movement, leading the pro-life movement and taking that place of authority in the movement. I think that that's very important. Not saying men's voices aren't important in the pro-life movement. They absolutely are. But, you know, it's women that are being targeted by the abortion industry. It's women that are being targeted. And so it's up to us to really take back this narrative and reclaim that and to say, you know, we're not going to be victims to the abortion movement. We're not going to be victims to that narrative. We're going to stand up and we're going to stand against it.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Abby Johnson, who made a journey from being a Planned Parenthood director in a facility to becoming a pro-life activist, an advocate for women, an advocate for children, an advocate for the pro-life movement. And we are talking now about the pro-life movement today and really where it's headed. You know, Abby, I saw a comment you made on your Facebook page that was really interesting. You were preparing for the march, and you've just mentioned how every year the march is an interesting experience for you, and that you're taken aback sometimes by the lack of understanding surrounding the need to help those who are trapped in the abortion industry. And many people don't accept that. They don't accept that that some people are, like the words you used, trapped in the abortion industry. What would you like pro-lifers to know about workers in the abortion industry?
It's human nature. Anytime there's a tragedy, we look for someone to blame. We need to place blame on someone. And I think the natural group of people to place blame in the tragedy of abortion are people who work in the abortion industry. And I think it's important for us to remember that inside this movement, we have opponents, but we do not have enemies. Mm-hmm. And people that work inside the abortion clinics, people who perform abortions, physicians, they are not our enemies, even though they may be our opponents. And they are misguided people, but they are people whose conversion is very possible. And I think that it's easy for us to forget sometimes that, you know, these people are, they're sinners just like us, but they're normal people. They're not people with horns and a pitchfork and a tail. They're moms, they're, you know, dads, they're friends.
Sure.
They're just normal everyday people. Sometimes they go to church with you, they worship with you, you see them every day on the street, and they're all worthy of redemption and forgiveness. And, you know, our ministry, particularly in this year of mercy, I mean, we are, you know, our message is one of hope and one of conversion. And, you know, we believe that no one is beyond the power of conversion because no one is beyond the power of Christ. And just in our ministry, and then there were none, in the past 3 years, we have seen over 200 abortion clinic workers and abortion doctors leave the industry and seek healing
through.
And then there were none. And so it's just been very exciting for us. We see this as sort of a new era in the pro-life movement. It's a new way of thinking. It's thinking about a group of people who maybe have not been thought of before.
Sure.
And thinking of them in a new way.
Sure.
And in a way of that really lends itself to compassion and mercy.
You know, Abby, your message is very powerful because you have that personal experience of having been on the other side, if you will. But how can I help someone? I mean, I haven't seen the other side. I don't know that perspective. Am I really believable when I try to reach out? How do I do that?
You know, we have various resources on our website. We get that question a lot, you know, how can I reach out to someone? And it's interesting because one of the things that one of the workers told us when they left was, you know, they said, I knew that God would forgive me. I knew that you guys, you know, people who had been there before, you know, people like me who had been in the abortion church, mm-hmm. I knew that you guys would understand. I knew that. But they said the one thing I didn't expect was forgiveness from the pro-life movement.
Wow.
And that was really profound. That really struck me because they're being told very different things on the inside of the abortion clinic, that pro-lifers hate them, that they're a very unforgiving group of people. And so I think one of the things that we can really do to sort of combat that is to share from our hearts, you know, with the workers that are still in the clinics. And so we have put together some resources on our website, abortionworker.com. Under the resources tab, there's some printable resources there. And we encourage people to, you know, just write a letter to your local abortion clinic, to your local Planned Parenthood clinic, even if they're just a referral clinic. And you can use some of the verbiage off of our website, just letting them know that you're there, that you care about them, and that there's hope and there's a way out and there's a group of people there that have resources that can help them get another job and find healing. Sometimes they just need that little that little push in the right direction.
Sure.
They just need that support. And so that's a very simple yet tangible thing that you can do that can lead someone through that door of conversion.
Sure. And that website is abortionworker.com. We have just one minute left, and I did want to ask you, where do you see the most hope?
Well, you know, for us, I mean, we believe that the hope in the pro-life movement is not just about making abortion illegal, but it's about making it unthinkable. And we believe that making abortion unthinkable will happen through conversion, through changing one heart and one mind at a time. And we believe that the paradigm shift from a culture of death to a culture of life will happen through that conversion. And we believe that abortion clinic workers are a huge part of that. Changing their hearts is a huge part of that paradigm shift. And we're just really honored to be a part of that work.
Well, we're honored to have you on as our guest today. Thank you so much, Abby, for being with us.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll talk about the hijacking of the women's movement with someone who's been there. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
In today's world, we have all kinds of misinformation and even disinformation about Christianity, Catholicism, and religion in general. And we need a source that is going to give us direct quotations and authentic news about what is going on in the church, so we know what the Pope really said and not what the media said he said. We need to know what the Synod is doing, what the encyclicals mean, in order to be able to give the facts of our faith. For that reason, we need the National Catholic Register, which will give us the good news along with the hard news of our world today. And in that way, we can have what we need to go out to our world and give them the good news of Jesus Christ.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DiMello, I'm Tom Price. Now, you may not know that contraception and abortion were not originally part of the 1960s women's movement. So how did this movement that fought for equal opportunity for women in education and the workplace and the sexual revolution, which reduced women to ambitious sex objects, become so united? Our next guest, Sue Ellen Browder, documents for the first time how it all happened in her life and in the life of an entire country in her book, Subverted, available now from the EWTN Religious Catalog. Her in-depth research, her probing analysis, and her honest self-reflection sets the record straight and illumines a way forward for others who have suffered from that unholy alliance.
Well, Sue Ellen, it is great to have you on Register Radio. We talked not too long ago about the Planned Parenthood videos that had brought to everyone's attention what was going on in Planned Parenthood regarding the selling of unborn baby parts. It's a horrible tragedy that we talked about. But now we're talking about a very interesting topic, and this is your memoir. It's your latest book, Subverted. And I read that book this week, and I have to tell you, I hardly know where to start in doing this interview and having this conversation with you because the book was so good. Thank you for writing it. I'm sure writing a memoir is a very difficult thing to do and probably takes a very long time. How long was this book in the works?
It's been, well, it'll be officially 5 years this month.
Wow.
So it took a good 4 years of research and writing, and then some rewriting and fact-checking and all of that. So it's been a good 5 years in the making.
Yes, well, it's a superb book, so I hope everyone will read it after listening to our conversation. Now, this book, it's a history and a memoir, and that's why it needed so much fact-checking, because it wasn't simply your story. Your story was intertwined, and the subtitle of the book, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement, really gives an indication of what historical context we're talking about. And one of the things that really struck me was that you show the difference between the women's movement in its origin and that it was separate from the sexual revolution. And I'd like to start with that very thing. How was the women's movement in the beginning?
Okay, well, when I was in college, the women's movement was gaining full force. It had been started in 1963 with Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. That was the beginning. And women in those days, there were a lot of things that needed to be changed. I was fired in 1969 for being pregnant. You could only work 5 months, and then after that you had to quit with no promise of having a job again. Married women could not apply for credit in their own names. There were a lot of med schools and law schools that did not allow women to in. There were a lot of things in the women's movement that the women's movement was fighting against, inequalities in the workforce and in education, because women were pouring into the culture at that time, into the workplace, and they were finding all sorts of terrible discrimination. So that was the women's movement, and that was started by Betty Friedan, and then it was also started by a bunch of women in Washington, D.C., who, again, working women who were running into these log jams in their lives and needed some help. Now, the sexual revolution, which was at Cosmo, I went to work for Cosmo in the early 1970s, what I noticed there was the sexual revolution and the women's movement were two radically different movements. Betty Friedan called Cosmo quite obscene and quite horrible.
Right.
Cosmo was promoting the sexual agenda. It was good to sleep with a married man, good to take the pill, good or at least necessary to have an abortion to get ahead if you became inconveniently pregnant. Our cosmopolitan philosophy turned all traditional values upside down. So you had these two radically different movements. But one dark night in Washington, D.C. in 1967, they were joined together in the eyes of the media.
And that's right. And that chapter of the book had a very interesting title, and it was A Fly on the Wall of the Chinese Room. What happens in the Chinese Room in Washington, D.C.?
Well, now, this was all stuff that I researched as an investigative reporter. I was not there, but I was telling my personal story. So how are we going to go off and tell what happened in the women's movement without leaving the personal story? So
sure.
I'm a fly on the wall in the Chinese room, and the reader is there with me, and we're watching what happened. The Chinese room of the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. on November 18, 1967, was the second annual conference of the National Organization for Women, and that was the night that they inserted abortion into the women's movement as a right. And they named 8 rights that night. They were creating a Bill of Rights, a political Bill of Rights that was going to be their political platform, that is still the political platform that we're dealing with today. I mean, 50 years later, this political platform is still with us. They had 8 rights, and only 2, and most of them were women shouldn't be fired for being pregnant. They wanted family leave, maternity leave for women. They wanted these very things that women really needed. You know, at that time, in some states, women couldn't serve on juries.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an entirely different age, and people forget that. But okay, so there were 2 battles that day over which rights would be inserted. Some of them were everybody agreed, but 2 of them were fought over. One was the Equal Rights Amendment, which is now history. That's long been almost forgotten because it didn't pass. The other one was abortion, which we're still fighting today.
Right. Can you believe it?
Can you believe it? And there were only about 100 people in that room that night. And the abortion vote, Betty Friedan sprang it on everybody. They didn't expect her to do this. A lot of them didn't. It wasn't on the agenda. She just kind of popped it on them, and they had this vicious fight over it. It lasted till almost midnight. And after that vote, there were only 57 people that night that voted to insert abortion in the women's movement. And 1/3 of these very ardent feminists walked out of that meeting and later resigned over the abortion vote. We had a split in the women's movement right that very night that we're still fighting today.
That's right, and you mentioned the split. It's even groups that hardly can even talk to one another any longer because they are so entrenched in their own point of view in this issue. Uh-huh. So the book is illuminating in what it presents in the historical factor, but it's also it's your personal story that's woven in that I think will really touch the hearts of so many people. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the personal story, but I did have one question. Betty Friedan, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that she was not for the sexual revolution. She was not interested in abortion right. at the beginning. So how did this happen? How did she pop this amendment or this right on the women's group?
Okay, you're right. Betty Friedan did not even mention abortion or contraception in the feminine mystique. The idea of reproductive rights was not even on her radar at that point. But there were two men, Larry Leder and Dr. Bernard Nathanson. They were the co-founders of what became the National Abortion Rights Action League and is now NARAL Pro-Choice America. And Larry's fiercest ambition, he was a population planner, and his fiercest ambition in life was to repeal all abortion laws. And he worked on Betty for years to try to get her to see his view that women needed abortion to be free. And he finally convinced her with a book that he had written. It was a masterpiece of propaganda. It was just called Abortion, but the subtitle, listen to this. It was called Abortion. Listen to the propagandistic subtitle. The first authoritative and documented report on the laws and practices governing abortion in the U.S. and around the world, and how, for the sake of women everywhere, they can and must be reformed.
Wow.
That's the subtitle of the book. This was a masterpiece of propaganda. It convinced Betty that abortion would help set women free. And somehow, Larry said that they had to recruit the feminists. He told Dr. Bernard Nathanson they had to recruit the feminists to get their abortion movement going, and he succeeded. Larry knew Betty very well. They were both magazine writers in New York, both Jewish atheists with Marxist leanings. They had a lot in common. But as I say, Betty had been a mother of three. Her book was made no mention of abortion. And even in the year 2000, she said, ideologically, I was never for abortion. Yeah. Motherhood is a value to me, and even today, abortion is not. I believed passionately, she says, in 1967, as I do today, that women should have the right of chosen motherhood. For me, the matter of choice has never been primarily the choice of abortion, but that you can choose to be a mother. That is as important as any right written into the Constitution.
You would never know that. You would never know that looking at the feminist movement today.
No, because when they joined those two, when they inserted abortion rights into the women's movement that night, the next Monday morning, she stood up. There had been only 57 people that voted that night for abortion, and it had been a fierce battle. On Monday morning, she told the press that she was speaking for 28 million working women all over America, millions of women emerging from our colleges, millions of mothers who were trying to go back to work. She basically claimed to be speaking for all working women. In fact, she was only speaking for 57 people in the Chinese room. And the next day, the Washington Post ran a story that said, now supports the furthering of the sexual revolution of our century by pressing for widespread sex education and provision of birth control and the repeal of all abortion laws.
It's as if one woman just completely changed the course of history in that moment. I mean, it's just amazing. I was fascinated by that part of your book, Sue Ellen. I really, the historical elements of what you wrote and what you investigated are huge. Any woman who is interested in feminism or the new feminism needs to read this book. It's called Subverted: How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. It's by Sue Ellen Browder, who I'm talking with here on Register Radio right now. And Sue Ellen, I do want to talk a little bit about your own story, though, because that's what drove you really to write this book. It's a memoir. It's in your own voice. It talks about your
right.
own experience. And
right.
and how did you wake up to, I guess, the falsity of what was happening? Because you were working right there in the midst of it at Cosmopolitan Magazine.
Yes, I was. And I had a beautiful, beautiful marriage to Walter, and we had two children. And we had this lovely, I was living this lovely life behind the scenes while I was selling this hardcore Cosmo philosophy, basically, to make a buck. I mean, Cosmo paid very, very well, and Walter and I wanted to be freelance writers, and we wanted to have our freedom. And I honestly, in those days, of course, would have no idea what would happen to all of this. So at that time, I thought, oh, this is just a fantasy. Women are not going to buy into this. Well, of course, they did buy into it.
Right.
They bought into it big time. And when I began to look back, I think the moment that I began to realize the horror of the damage that this had done and how much I had played into that was when Walter and I, after we became Catholics, we went to a conference where Dr. Bernard Nathanson was. And you know, he was one of the co-founders of NARAL, and he had taken responsibility, he said, for not personally doing them, but overseeing 70,000 abortions before he converted to, well, before he became pro-life, and then later he converted from Judaism to Catholicism. So he was at that meeting, and he started talking about all the lies they'd told in the abortion movement to convince people that we needed the abortion rights. And I realized, well, I had done some research, and I realized that Kinsey science had been all flawed, and one scientist had called this propaganda masquerading as science. And then I thought, well, Cosmo, we lied there too. We made up a lot of those stories. Those women weren't real that were jumping into bed with everybody. We made them up. And I suddenly realized, well, if the abortion movement was made up of propaganda, and Kinsey's sexual revolution was made up of propaganda, and Cosmo was made up of propaganda, it was all smokescreen.
Yeah.
And that's when I began to say, hey, I mean, and feel very guilty and contrite about that, and realizing the horrible part I had played in that.
I really hope that many people have the opportunity to read this book and are touched by the same kind of mercy that you were touched by in you know, the part you played in this, but now that you're turning it around to tell the story, and that truly is God's mercy.
Oh, so, absolutely. He's with us all the way.
Amen. So, Sue Ellen, thank you for writing for The Register and for all the work that you've done.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Again, this very powerful book, Subverted, is available from the EWTN Religious Catalog. Just go to EWTNRC.com. And don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen or download the show. Thanks for joining us this time on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at The Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.